Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, better crack on. Love Island's on.
It is Thursday, which means it's time for the Front 3 Q&A. Ladies and gentlemen, with me, Adam Boltwood. Nico Morales.
How you doing, Adam?
I'm doing very well. And Chris Hennage is here as well. Chris, how you doing?
Evening, Adam.
Feels like it's been a while. Chris, how are you? What have you been up to? What's going on in the world of Chris Hennage?
World Cup prep. A piece on Magnus Ekram that's now dropped for Seattle Sounders.
Okay.
And just preparing to move across the globe.
Wow. Very exciting. Across the Atlantic?
Yeah, to New York,
when's it happening?
It will be happening in August, so it'll be maybe one of the smaller summer transfers, but I like to think just as important.
It's a summer transfer.
And so, yeah, I'm now just trying to realise what I can take and what I need to get rid of, basically. It's a lot of books, which I think is a good thing. I've not read any of them, but, yeah, you know, I guess it looks good.
What about you, Nico? What have you been up to?
World Cup prep, doing a lot of writing, which is good. Piece on defending, piece on Pochettino's influence on England coming early next week.
Sounds good.
And yeah, then Messi. But yeah, I got really sad actually when you tweeted out the tweet for the questions this week, because you included like a picture of the World Cup ball, and I had bought one I want to say 2 months or a month and a half back, and I was playing with it because I love the World Cup balls, and I was playing with it at my local park, and I shot it over. It was a great shot, great curler, nice power. It just missed the goal, and it went right into a thorn bush.
Really?
Well, you know, objective, but it went right into a thorn bush.
You almost hit it too well, as that sounds.
Some would say I hit it too well, but yeah, it went right into a thorn bush, completely deflated, completely ruined, air bladders popped, so $200 down the drain.
You bought a full-on World Cup.
It was in the interest of the Front 3, because I was going to come on, because there was actually something at the time, maybe we can talk about this, but there was something at the time where David De Gea and like two other goalkeepers were talking about how they didn't like the new World Cup ball because of whatever, and I was going to, you know, test it out, and I actually did come to some of my own conclusions in the 45 minutes that I got to use it.
Yeah, don't kick it in a thorn bush, for example.
Yeah, before it completely deflated. So, I mean, don't roast me here. I'm putting in the money, the time for the podcast, Adam. What are you doing?
It's normal. You just $200
planning your wedding. You're just doing whatever the hell you want to do.
I just would never. Many a time I've been confronted about, should I pay the full whack for a proper ball, you know, the standard match ball, or should I just get a replica? It's a replica every single time, because you know you're going to kick it in a forward.
Here's the difference, Adam. You live in London, so there is a lot of stuff to do there outside of just being physical. I live in Orlando, Florida. There is not a whole lot to do. So World Cup ball is my only joy.
Go to theme parks every single day. That's what happens.
Yeah, that's how it works. No, it's filled with pasty English people like you and Chris.
It's true. It's very true, to be fair. Guys, we've got a lot to talk about. There's been a lot that's been going on in the world of football in the last week. The World Cup's coming, as the guys are saying here. They've been prepping. We've got so much to talk about, as well as your questions as well in part two. They've been coming on Twitter. Some great ones to dig into. Before that, though, it's time for Hole of the Week. Review of the Week, as always. And there's only one. There's only one candidate, so fair play to the only Taps from Canada who submitted a 5-star review on iTunes. He entitled it Great Pod. He said, great podcast, been listening for a few while, and this is slowly becoming one of my top football podcasts behind La Liga Weekly. Keep it up, lads. Bring back Statman Dave. Smiley face. You never know. The only taps. Dave might be coming back for the World Cup. We'll see. Let's move swiftly on, though. There's so much to talk about. As I said, in the world of football, there's so much going on. It's difficult to know where to start. I feel like the start at the beginning. Some news that came out a couple of days ago, really. And this was the curious case of Loris Karius, Chris. Now, earlier this week, it was revealed that he was possibly suffering from concussion during the Champions League final.
The information about the concussion, obviously FSG is Fenway Sports Group, and they are owners of the Boston Red Sox, and so I think they did an independent medical study via the video camera angles, and obviously Karius himself on the doctors that they have on staff there, and they came to the medical conclusion that he was likely concussed in some way, shape, or form.
Yes. Massachusetts General, a doctor who assessed the Liverpool goalkeeper in Boston. He was sent for a head scan there last week. This was, of course, when this sort of emerged amid concern at the club at his reaction to a collision with Sergio Ramos. Now, I think it's fair to say this news was met with a mixed response, Chris. And in my opinion, it seemed like quite an immature response. I mean, I've seen some of your tweets that would be interesting to get your thoughts, but yeah. The reaction I saw seemed to suggest to me that perhaps people don't fully grasp concussion or don't understand the serious nature of it, and therefore didn't treat this news and this revelation with perhaps the seriousness it deserved.
Yeah, I think it's a problem that's endemic in football that we haven't really caught up with the other major sports as it pertains to understanding of concussions and kind of their severity, the protocol that surrounds them. Football has a concussion protocol. But again, when it comes to actually supporters, people watching, understanding what has happened or happening, and then the fallout from that, I think we're still pretty far behind. There was a doctor whose name is escaping me right now who talked about temporary substitutions as a way to work with concussions within the sport, because it gives the doctors and medical team a chance to assess the player in question and whether they have actually suffered a concussion. But I think the problem with the carry situation is kind of what you alluded to, that it was very immature in so much as people instantly took it as an excuse for his performance, which it's absolutely not. That's not what I think the majority of people were trying to get at. Certainly there would be some who would look to it that way, but I think the much larger and much more significant point was that there was a football player who continued playing with a potential concussion. And a lot of people, I even got two guys today who sort of mocked the fact that I said this could have been fatal if he'd suffered another head knock in sort of any ways. And that's the other problem, is that I think it's called second impact syndrome. It's still very much in the discovery stage as a condition, because they're not sure of a lot of the aspects towards it. But essentially, it pertains to, if you do suffer a second impact after a concussion, it can be fatal. It can cause severe disability, mental problems. I even read a story just in kind of looking it up of an American football player, I think at high school level maybe, who did not recover and was not given space from the first concussion, and then suffered another head impact and essentially became paralyzed from it. So there's a lot of seriousness attached to this, because you have to remember it pertains to the head and the brain is this really fragile, I'm really careful not to use wrong scientific terms here, but fragile organ in our body that once it's damaged, it's almost impossible to fix. That's the problem, is that it's not something that can, you know, regenerate like a liver or something like that. It is a very fragile piece of us that we really do need to take care of. And I think if we're going to talk about, scanning players' brains for heading related injuries and such like after they finish their careers and that impact, we have to take the present just as seriously and look at players and how best to protect them from concussion consequences.
I think that's a fair point, isn't it, Nico? Because, I mean, I was reminded of, it was Christoph Kramer in the 2014 World Cup final, who took a heavy blow to the head
in that game against Argentina. And afterwards, he asked the ref, is this the World Cup final? You know, the referee thought he was joking. But then Christoph Kramer actually was saying, you know, is this the World Cup final right now? He was very disorientated. He's very confused. He played on until the 31st minute when he sort of slumped over and was then replaced. But I think, as Chris is sort of alluding to there, there was kind of this quite tribalistic response along club lines, people ridiculing Karius, ridiculing the club for what they saw was an excuse for his performance in the Champions League final. But like Chris says, surely this continuing issue of concussion in sport is something that we should be having a much more mature conversation about. As Chris says, how do you deal with this in the game? How do you make sure that something more serious doesn't happen again in the future?
Yeah, I think the main thing that I want to hammer down with this entire issue is that I think for football, I think there is a genuine possibility of people making major strides in terms of our understanding of concussions, because there is less of a motivation to cover things up. So as we've seen with various films, documentaries, and articles and investigations, the NFL, which I think probably is the leading sport that you would have a degree of data or subjects to study in terms of concussion and brain impact, which is what we're talking about. You would have, you know, a plethora of that, but there has been a concentrated effort by the NFL and the people around it to sort of shove those things under the rug. And I think the reason that people don't take these things as seriously, obviously, is because the as Chris is saying, the brain and our understanding of it and how it works, these things are still very much in this discovery stage. So things that are now that are becoming more and more apparent are a consequence of repeated brain impact, like depression and mental health issues and other issues within the body. Those things are becoming more and more understood now, but in the past, you know, the generations of our fathers and the ones before them, those things were just kind of, and since it's not, you know, a black and white situation where every single, you know, heavy impact to a player's head is going to cause, you know, if it was as easy to see as that, like every time somebody got hit in the head, they had this specific consequence, then I think, you know, that our understanding of us as a society of these things would be furthered. But since it's so varied and since everybody's brain and each impact is different, we have a more, I don't know, we don't have as good of an understanding of what the consequences are. And I think Malcolm Gladwell did a really good podcast on it recently, where they're kind of studied. They have more and more you know, results and studies on these things, and it's called Tau-5, which is the protein that supposedly gets released into the brain tissue after repeated brain impact, and that is actually heavily linked to serious cases of depression and schizophrenia and all these other mental health disorders that we don't take that seriously. And I think that's the reason that people don't see it as a major issue, is because we as a society don't have a great grasp on mental health issues. We don't have a great grasp of how these things work. But if there is a concrete thing that we can say in a lot of these cases for football players, for soccer players, for whoever is causing these things, and people understand that, then I think people will have a more profound respect for those who have undergone brain trauma and repeated brain trauma and might possibly suffer the consequences of that.
On a similar note, we also had Danny Rose this week, the England fullback, revealing his depression diagnosis. I think something that was treated with much more maturity by the newspapers, by fans alike as well. But the Tottenham player came out, disclosed the illness in an interview this week with the England squad. We give international newspapers, talking about how it's triggered by a combination of injury and family tragedy as well. And he's rightly been applauded for that, Chris, for that honesty.
100%, because mental health in football, again, it sounds like we're possibly bleeding the boring drum, but it's another situation that is not covered enough, and I think it's something that maybe we don't always want to address because it's not the easiest conversation to have. And I think actually mental health problems specifically are a lot more prevalent in football than we might want to admit. And the fact that we have a senior England international, coming forward and say, yes, I had a problem, this is how I solved it, I'm in a better position now than I was, you know, 6-8 months ago, whatever. That's really important, because it's not necessarily about anointing these players as role models, because I think that's not their job. But I think they can still make themselves relatable to people. And I'd be very surprised if there isn't a person out there who read that interview with Danny Rose, read those quotes and thought, you know what, I need to get some help for something that's bothering me that's either similar to this or within that wheelhouse. And I think ultimately that's the most important thing.
There's one more bit of news to talk about before we move on to maybe some of the transfer news and the questions, etc. I did want to talk a little bit about some of the developments in the Premier League today, because there's a couple of interesting tidbits that could have a big impact on the future of England's top division. First off, Richard Scudamore is stepping down. He's been the Premier League chief executive for nearly 20 years. He's going to be stepping down at the end of 2018. Now, this is a character, this is a man in the industry who's been, I think it's fair to say, criticised, Chris, for what seems to be a more financially motivated approach to the Premier League. Would you think that's fair to say? What sort of impact do you think Scudamore stepping down could have on the Premier League?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it's fair to say that he is the man that has steered the ship through fairly significant growth of the Premier League as a marketing force, as you know, something that commands huge, huge revenue from its TV rights. And to that end, you have to give him credit. Now, in the same breath, I would say that there were times when he took that too far. You think of, you know, the talk of the 39th game possibly being abroad, that there's limits to it. Do you know what I mean? That when you start talking about playing games abroad and sort of drastically changing the competition to almost appeal solely to those foreign viewers, I think you run a dangerous line personally.
I was going to say, based on what you said there about the TV revenues, on the article the BBC have about Scudamore stepping down, they say that when he joined, the television rights for the Premier League were 670 million. Now the last deal he secured is worth 5.14 billion. So it shows the extent to which those revenues have grown. I mean, the interesting thing is, Nico, this announcement comes on the same day that it was announced Amazon have won the rights to show 20 Premier League matches a season for 3 years in 2019. Again, the fee hasn't been disclosed, but you can be certain that it is a sizable amount of money divided now between Amazon, Sky, BT as well. You can see the direction that Scudamore's taken the Premier League in to becoming this financial behemoth, really.
Yeah, 100%. And I think probably the most interesting thing here is the Amazon thing, because I was listening to a Ringer podcast a while ago that kind of talked about, you know, people are now kind of mapping out and drawing lines, more concrete lines in the digital media sector, and Disney, Amazon, Netflix, all these guys. And obviously Netflix is a little bit separate because I don't think they have a focus on sports. But for a company that's as big as Amazon, they want to make a name for themselves in the sporting department. I think the Premier League is kind of the biggest fish that you can get. If they had bought Bundesliga or Serie A rights, that would be a different thing. But if you have rights for certain Premier League games, that certainly sets a precedent for a company like Amazon, a digital and tech behemoth as big as they are, kind of carving out their piece of what they want to do going forward, which is ultimately probably streaming and those kind of things. So it'll be really fascinating to see how that all pans out, because are we going to have a divided sort of streaming service? Are you only going to get certain leagues on certain, you know, services and providers, or is Amazon just going to take over from the beginning? Because as far as I can tell, they're one of the only ones that are doing this so far. So it, you know, obviously football is the biggest sport in the world, and them taking that with the Premier League and probably eventually some international competitions or the Champions League or whatever is a major step.
Perhaps the most fundamental change we could see, Chris, is the news today, along with these other two pieces, is that the top six Premier League clubs appear to have won their battle to be paid a greater share of international TV revenues. Now, this is Man City, Liverpool, Man United, Arsenal, Chelsea and Spurs sort of pressing this case that they should be paid more money from international broadcasters because they are the main attraction for international audiences, and therefore they should receive more money. Now, this will be the first time this happened for 26 years. It's been shared equally among all the Premier League's clubs, which I think is an incredibly admirable way of doing business, especially when, you know, in the Liga it's been Barcelona and Real Madrid sort of getting the majority of the TV revenue and therefore strengthening their own sort of stranglehold on the league. It appears now that it has been approved and that from potentially 2020, any additional revenue in the TV rights will be distributed according to where these teams finish in the league. So the higher you finish, the more money you get. I mean, what do you make of this? It feels like a negative change from my point of view, because as I say, the democratic way of doing it, dividing it equally, has led to the incredible strength of the Premier League. And I think making it such an exciting domestic competition, this feels like it could be the beginning of the big teams always finishing the top six, where there's less competition, where the best get better, and everyone else is sort of falls behind. We're already seeing that this season, where the teams seem to be divided into two leagues, if you will, the top six and the rest. This is only going to make that more pronounced, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's my slight disappointment in this, is that if you're... Because essentially the top six as it stands now, yeah, because Burnley finished seventh, the top six is pretty locked in stone for my mind. And I just feel as if, for that reason, it just means the rich are going to get richer, and then they already spend a significant amount. I mean, there was someone, a chap who does a lot of finance stuff on Newcastle and their balance sheets and everything, who worked out the last eight players Newcastle bought totaled roughly the same as what Man United just spent on Fred. Now, that's a fairly hefty disparity. And granted, you know, Man United are challenging for the league, Newcastle definitely aren't. But it does, to me, paint a little bit of a picture to the disparity between them. And I can only see that getting bigger. And for the actual competition of the league, I don't think that will make it any better. I think, if anything, it probably means that the talent will just gravitate to the top, whereas I think there's more benefit in having a Wilf Zaha, Palace, or having teams not sort of collect the talent, if you will, all to one place.
And I'd also be, I think, an important thing to kind of consider as well is, like, I would imagine that a lot of the people at these negotiating tables, the ones that ultimately have more power for what the league's going to do in terms of these rules and these newer rules, are the biggest clubs. Because as we saw, I don't know if it was 2 years ago now or a year ago, the biggest clubs in Europe were kind of talking about breaking away from the Champions League, creating their own sort of European Super League type thing. And I think the only reason those talks have gone away is because that is kind of, that's their, you know, gun to the head type of situation. They can threaten the leagues, they can threaten the Champions Leagues because of the power that they have as those clubs. And as we're seeing, I forget where I read it, but either UEFA or someone has considered or has already changed the rules in terms of terms of qualification and the points that those teams hold. It'll be done over, or supposedly it'll be done over, like a 10-year basis. So if you have a significant degree of pedigree within Europe, and you know you only have one or two bad years, you'll always have more points and more qualifying points, and an upper hand to some extent on teams that are breaking into that. And I think it goes along further with this idea that those people at these bigger clubs, they don't just want to be there right now and have the best players right now. They're making serious financial changes, both in the rules and, you know, everywhere else, to make sure that they're cementing their place as a team that's never going to drop out of Europe, that's always going to be in these highly broadcasted, highly high money making competitions and such.
I understand that impulse. At the end of the day, we live in a capitalist society, and obviously these are businessmen who want to make sure they've got the most valuable product, but it's depressing.
It's funny how it changes, because you would argue that them closing off the rules, right, to other people, you know, bringing themselves up by their own quality, would be a less democratic process, or less, at least to some extent, capitalistic process. But it changes once you're at the top. You don't want anybody else to come up there with you. You don't care if it's by their own merit.
Sit on top of the mountain and no one else can get
it. Yeah. Essentially, whether it's unfair or not, is you don't really give a shit about that, right?
And that's the depressing thing. You think, like I say, I understand it from a business point of view, but you know, football, the beautiful game, the most popular sport in the world, you want the people who can make changes, the people who can influence the sport at the very top, to have a more idealistic and a more democratic view of how the sport should be. But you know, I think it's been moving in this direction for years now. We've seen with FIFA, for example, the lawmakers of the game who govern the entire sport, that, you know, that is their sole purpose, making money. We'll see that at the World Cup again this summer, I'm sure. But it is kind of depressing to see that it seems to be a general trend in the game, that it is moving in that direction. And the Premier League, who, as we said, for the last 26 odd years have been a much more fairly run organization in terms of the distribution of the revenues that are generated by everyone in the league, it's going in the opposite direction now. And I think that's kind of it's sad to see, I think. And hopefully, you know, it doesn't mean the end necessarily for the domestic TV rights.
But I think there is a genuine possibility of the football bubble exploding. Like, if we're not...
Very much so.
We are, and this is massively off topic, and we'll only be here for a second, but, like, we are in the stages, according to a lot of people, like, in the stages of very late capitalism. And, I mean, I can't imagine a scenario where, you know, Neymar was technically... He triggered his own release clause by an out of state nationalist organization that wanted to, you know, buy him and bring him to PSG for their own political reasons. I can't imagine a situation becoming bigger than that. Like, when countries start buying players for political reasons, where there's no ceiling, you have broken the ceiling. That's it.
Good old football player. Good old working class football. speaking of which, let's move on to some transfer talk. Some exciting transfer moves going on this week. The most recent of which we should mention is sort of breaking as we're on the pod here, is that Nabil Fekir is very close to moving to Liverpool. That's according to the BBC, so you know you can trust it. $53 million is the reported deal from the 24-year-old from Lyon. Obviously, a player who's sort of set Europa light this season, Nico. 18 goals and 8 assists in Ligue 1. Do they really need Fekir? He plays on the right side of the attack, or he plays through the centre as well. Does this lead credence to potentially Sadio Mane is on his way to Real Madrid? Do they really need another attack like this?
No. Don't start that, Adam. I know you're a Spurs fan.
I'm just fueling the rumours. I'm just fueling.
No, I actually talked to Chris about this on one of the last pods. But for me, because we kind of talked about the Fabinho transfer to Liverpool as well, and I said, you know, that the Fabinho transfer makes more sense in terms of it's in line with a lot of how Liverpool have done their business. They buy flexible players that can fit into the cog of a system, and this is painting in very broad strokes. But for me, like I said on that podcast, Fekir is a different one, because although he does kind of fit into the profile of a Liverpool player, he presses well, he has a lot of really elevated defensive actions, and StatsBomb with like their new data collection is kind of paving the way for quantifying these players a little bit better. They did a good article on him. Ted Knutson did it, and so did Mohamed. But I think Fekir is slightly different, because whereas before they buy these flexible players that have less of a concrete identity and can just fit into different parts of the system, Fekir is clearly an attacking player. And I think that's where the transfer policy changes for Liverpool. They're not only now looking to break into the top four and just kind of be there, I imagine under Klopp, they're kind of putting all their eggs in one basket and saying, okay, we want a league title under Klopp. And in order to do that, you need highly specialized pieces. You need a Fekir that can, you know, unlock a defense, which is part of the reason why they struggled. Like, they will have to rotate. And the more talented players that you have in a rotation set, as you were saying, you know, does this leave space for Mane to go to Real Madrid? No, I think they're going to have both of them, and they're going to intend to use both of them. Maybe not at the same time, but they need to rotate if they want to pick up more points in the league and they want to be league title competitors. And a team, or rather a player that is as talented as Fekir in terms of like a sole attacking player, is the kind of recruitment that Liverpool need to go ahead and make that final step to the Cities and the Uniteds and whoever else of the world that's challenging for the title. So I think this is a pivotal moment for Liverpool, because their transfer policy is changing from, okay, let's just buy Klopp players, to, okay, let's buy talented Klopp players. You know what I mean?
It's scary. It's scary, honestly, as a Spurs fan, to see them making this level of signing and this suit in the window, Fabinho, Fekir as well. It looks ominous, I think it's fair to say. Some other deals going down in the Premier League, though. Arsenal signing Steven Lichtensteiner from Juventus, 34-year-old right back.
Yeah, broken Swedish 34-year-old. Yeah. Or is he Swedish?
It's not the most exciting move, Chris, but is it an astute move to sign Stefan Lichtensteiner on a free from Juventus? Feels like, you know, I think I saw on Twitter someone described it as the sort of move you've made within the first 2 minutes of logging on to Football Manager. You know, it's got that air about it. It's a certain smartness to it.
I mean, look, he's got tremendous experience with Juventus. He's won, I think, 7 league titles or something. I saw stupid like that. That said, the concern I have outside of those intangibles of experience like that is, you know, they've got Hector Bellerin already. So unless maybe they're going to change formation and do what sort of Pep and Southgate are doing by playing a fullback as a centre-back and going with back three. I'm not sure where he fits in necessarily. I wouldn't have thought right-back competition was a desperate need. It might push Bellerin a little bit, but either way, they're both sort of quite high quality. To use a football manager analogy, they're both four-star players. So it seems a little bit needless. I have to give it the context, though, the fact they're going to sign Sokratis as well from Dortmund, which, again, it's another one of those deals where I'm like, maybe a couple of years ago I could understand that, but now it's certainly not the gem on earth thing that I think we were not promised so much as was alluded to when Sven Mislintat came in. And I think if they're going to continue down this road of giving a bit more experience, going for those guys 27 and older, that's a little bit of a concern. I mean, they've got Mavropanos, who I thought looked good in sort of fits and starts, because he only did play very briefly towards the end of the season, obviously. So maybe if it's the plan is to get him and Sokratis together, and then Lichtsteiner on the right, that's the problem. It just feels way too early to draw huge conclusions, because I almost want to see what else they're going to do. I think in isolation, it's not a terrible signing, but come September, it could look like a really poor one.
What about Manchester United, Nico? There's a deal in place for Brazilian midfielder Fred, who seems to have suffered an injury today in Brazil training, so might not make the World Cup. Remains to be seen what happens there. But £52 million is the move that's been agreed with Shakhtar Donetsk. They also confirmed the signing today of, I'm going to try and pronounce this correctly, Diogo Dalot? Delo? Diogo Delo?
I think it's Delo, but
Diogo,
yeah,
Delo, that sure sounds nice. Who I think Mourinho described as the most talented fullback of his generation, in his age group, I should say. I'm sure Trent Alexander-Arnold wasn't overly impressed with that. But what do you make of these signings? Again, two big signings early in the window. Fred, the most eye-catching potentially because of that 47 to 52 million reported fee. Are these good moves for Mourinho to add up?
I know less about Delo, but I can sort of contextualize it in the Mourinho thought, which is that I think, similar to any manager, they don't want to try to perpetuate a style of football that at the top you have to be risky in possession. And Mourinho doesn't want to, you know, play a style of football that would sacrifice defensive solidity without first knowing and trusting the players that he has on the field. And I think Delo probably fits into that profile. Like, he can be a little bit riskier in possession, put more forward, put more, you know, give Paul Pogba more freedom or whatever, take more risks in possession in terms of how they move the ball forward, because he feels more secure in the players that he has. I think that's probably the move with this player. As for Fred, I've seen a little bit more of him. I think he's a very good player. I think Manchester City were in for him as well, but then they stopped their interest because of Jorginho. I think Fred's a very good player. The only concern that I have is that I think going from a Francesca system at Donetsk that is more similar to that of Sarri and eventually Pep Guardiola to a Manchester United team is going to be difficult for any player because of the differences in play, I think we can say. But ultimately, I think Manchester United fans should be excited for both of them, because I think if they've had any excuses in the past in terms of Paul Pogba and his inability to play because of the way that the midfield is set up, I have to imagine that the midfield three of Paul Pogba, Nemanja Matic, and Fred, who I think will ultimately play as sort of that progressive midfielder that, you know, links the defense to the attack, is a really good one. And so if you have those three players and this Mourinho mindset that he only wants to do certain things when he feels like he has the right pieces, I feel like now more than ever, next year, there's really no excuses if they don't at least deliver on a more exciting style of attacking football that is ultimately fruitful. So I think the pieces are there for Manchester United now. It's just, as we've seen for the past 2 years now, it's up to Mourinho as to whether his players can deliver, because I think they're more than blessed with the talent, and he doesn't really have any excuses anymore.
Scary on paper. Teams around Spurs signing all these players, especially when the reports are we've pulled out of any move for Zaha because Palace wants 70 million.
But Adam, Pochettino has signed a new deal. He's not going to Real Madrid.
That is the main thing, to be fair. I'm still happy. You can't take that away from me. What about Leicester, another club who are making good moves?
Absolute blinder of
summer. Yes, they've just signed, it looks like, Johnny Evans. I think for 3.5.
Not for Johnny Evans, but the other ones.
Yeah, but I think that's a decent move. Nico, to add it complements the business they're already doing, and you've been impressed by them.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was Ricardo Pereira, I think is how you say his last name. But, yes. You know, Spurs should have been in for him for a long time. Exactly. And I think it sort of illuminates the Spurs transfer dealing, which is that they would rather, I think, the way the move panned out, given the fact that he went to Leicester, was that the player was probably willing to come to the Premier League when Spurs were interested last summer. The difficulty is probably somewhere along the way, whether it be the player, the club, or whatever, there was a hiccup where they would have had to pay more money. Whereas they looked at the market that time and said, okay, Serge Aurier is another decent option that we can get for somewhere that's within our budget. And so they went for him instead. And I think that's the thing that, you know, exemplifies the Spurs thing, is that they would have probably rather had Pereira because he's a really, really fantastic player. He's incredibly quick down the right-hand side. He's really attack-minded and he's athletic. He fits exactly into the mold of a player that Pochettino would want. I would almost liken him to a quicker and more athletic and even more attack-minded Kyle Walker. But they had to go with Serge Aurier because they needed to fill that gap in the summer, and that was really the only option unless they wanted to pay more, which of course they can't. And so for Leicester to get him, I think is a really big get, because they can perpetuate the style of football that we've known them to have, a defensive pressing, break on the counter and do those things. And I think he'll do really well in the Premier League along with the other players that they'll manage to get.
Okay, let's move on to the question.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Questions. So lots of questions coming in on Twitter. Nick Saldivia says, I know it's a lot of work, but could you guys do a draft game where you pick a starting 11 from World Cup players, but you only have one player per country, and then discuss who would win? Maybe not tonight, Nick. I think we'll do that next week. It's World Cup week next week. That's when all the content will be coming out. Don't you worry. Potentially the most interesting question, or one of the most interesting questions I've got tonight, is from Danny Othello, who says, what do you make of Yaya's recent unusual outburst? It was unusual, Nico, wasn't it? The quotes this week were from Yaya Toure, who's obviously left City this summer. He suggested that Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola often has problems with Africans. The Ivorian said he wants to break the myth about Guardiola, who he describes as jealous. Maybe we Africans are not always treated by the same by some in football. Interesting quotes. I think it's fair to say, Nico, what do you make of all this? Because obviously a lot of people are reading certain things into these quotes that Yaya Toure has made.
I think I'm a little bit torn, because on one hand, I think I've expressed my love for Yaya Toure on this podcast, and that hasn't changed. That's never going to change because of the things that he's done for the club that I like watching. And also, you know, I think we all have to respect his opinion and the things that he feels happened to him, and specifically the last year at Manchester City. That's what he's calling attention to, is that he feels like Pep Guardiola ruined his final season at Manchester City. But I think at the same time, so we should very seriously take the accusations that he has leveled at Guardiola, and we should take them, like I said, seriously. But I think to say that Guardiola is racist, or that I think he's treated players differently in the past, as far as I know, I think wouldn't be genuine, because Kevin De Bruyne has come out and backed Guardiola in this situation. I think a number of players have. And I think what's more likely is that Well, I would never say that Yaya is like a petty person, because I know some City fans have. They said, you know, oh, just look at what he did with the birthday cake situation. I think that was more of Dimitri Celik being his agent and just trying to get a higher fee for his contract at the time or whatever. I think at the same time, the very few interviews that exist out there with Yaya Touré are very telling. And I think it speaks of a player that has felt like they've been marginalized by the game and the coverage of the game, and probably subject to some racist coverage, or at least what he interprets to be racist coverage. Because if you look at his interview, he did like a 45-minute interview with somebody at Sky after City won the title, and he says, you know, if a white player had done the same thing, then, you know, they'd be... people would be talking about it like so much differently. And Samir Nasri came out and backed him and said that was true of the whole thing, and agreed with him and said, and I think he does have a point there. I think he has done some exceptional things in the game, and it hasn't been covered the same, whether that's because he's black, whether that's because he's African. I think it's more down to the fact that maybe he isn't the loudest guy out there, only in specific moments, and he's not really a marketable asset, so there's less media coverage of him. But I think that's the main thing that I want to push across, is that we have to respect Yaya's thoughts and feelings, but at the same time, I think genuine accusations that Guardiola is a racist, I think, are coming from someone that is feeling slighted by the game as a whole, and that sort of came to a culmination in his final year. And I think if you ask anyone at the club, if you ask anyone that looks at, you know, tactics or anything, the reason that Yaya didn't play for a long time is, or under Pep especially, and really towards the end of his City career, is because he wasn't willing to be a two-way player. Anybody that plays under Pep Guardiola knows that you have to counter-press, and you have to press, and you have to move a lot. You have to be very active, and you have to give your all for the team. And I think even before Pep came in, you know, there's an entire highlight reel of Yaya Touré not going into a sprint at all in the Champions League game versus Real Madrid, which was a quarterfinal. I mean, I think to just label Yaya Touré as a lazy player in those situations would be to completely ignore some of the criticism that he's gotten, and like I said before, how he's felt about the way that people have covered him, because he's done some amazing things in the game, and yet people, you know, people talk about Lampard and Gerrard and like they're miles above him. And I think if you're a player and you're seeing all that and you're not seeing much coverage about yourself despite being one of the best midfielders of all time, I think you have a right to be slighted. But I think this is more a case of him taking out his aggression on someone that he always had problems with throughout his entire career, both at Barcelona and Manchester City, as opposed to Guardiola being genuinely racist.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how it develops, really. I think we've seen Jerome Boateng, who obviously played under Guardiola at Bayern Munich, coming out and sort of supporting Guardiola in a sense. Kevin De Bruyne, another player, coming out and doing the same. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this develops, and if more voices are added to the chorus and to that suggestion that the Touré is making there. Moving on, other questions coming in on Twitter. Mr. Walker Porter says, ooh, the power free, referring to Rushfree. That's nice of you. Thank you very much. He said, breakout stars of the World Cup. Any ideas? What do you make of this one, Chris? Potential stars who are on the verge of breaking out internationally, who perhaps are set to have a fantastic tournament. I think the name on a lot of people's lips seems to be Timo Werner. Obviously, he's only 22 years old, has been fantastic for Leipzig in the past two seasons, but perhaps internationally speaking, on a broader stage, as the first choice starter front for Germany in this tournament, it feels like it could be his World Cup, Chris.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about football these days, is that we're so connected that everybody knows about everybody in theory. So these breakout stars are a little bit harder to peg. I think a few of the ones I'll be watching, that there was a Ringer piece by Mohamed that covered quite a few. Irving Lozano, who I'm familiar with from obviously watching CONCACAF qualifiers, the Mexican, I think is a decent shout. He'd been linked to Man United when he was at Pachuca many years ago. Hakim Ziyech of Morocco, who again is another one that I tracked. I would say maybe going back to when he was at 20, I used to try and catch games of theirs. And then at Ajax, I wrote a piece years ago now suggesting him for Sunderland. In fact, Sunderland actually had the chance to sign him for 9 million but turned it down. And it looks like now he's going to go for about three times that. I think Roma were linked, Dortmund were linked. The one that sort of I'm not overly familiar with, and I'm curious to see more, is Amin Harit, one of Ziyech's teammates with Morocco. He plays for Schalke, he's an attacking midfielder. I've watched little bits of Max Meyer at Schalke, who obviously didn't get into the Germany squad, like a lot of very good German players. But I think Amin Hart is one that I'm curious about and I've heard good things about. Other notable inclusions, they're pretty much who Mohamed tagged, to be honest. Pjonas Sisto is a good shout, the Danish winger who was at Midtjylland. And Goncalo Guedes was someone I think Dave may have tweeted about and talked about a lot as someone that he quite likes because he's been on loan at Valencia this season. Guedes, that is, not Dave. And yeah, I think there'll be some decent shouts, to be honest, because I think that's the difficulty. The only other one that springs to mind, actually, but then it sounds weird to call him breakout star because he's been talked about as a £100 million transfer, is Milinkovic Savic of Serbia. He's kind of this big... he's got some size to him, but he's fantastic with the ball at his feet as well. He's got pretty much everything you'd want from a midfielder. He's got that sort of Pogba mould to him in terms of, you know, very physically adept but good technically. He's another one that I think could really stand out in the Serbia side because I think Matic will give them the sort of foundation and organisation for him to thrive.
The Washington Post suggesting that Lionel Messi might be one of the players to watch out for. So keep your eye on him.
He might be.
I find that so weird, you know, that somewhere like, because the Washington Post is Stephen Goff, who's very good at what he does.
I get it, though. You know, if someone was saying the NBA finals are on right now, here's 10 players to watch, and it was a UK-based website, I'd be like, oh, great.
LeBron James.
Who is this LeBron? Maybe not LeBron James, I mean, but it is, I guess. What do you reckon, Nico? Any genuine shouts? Legitimate shouts for players to watch that you're excited to see who could be on the verge of sort of a more international breakout?
Like Chris, I will reference the Ringer article. I think Mohamed did a great job in writing it and I really enjoyed it. But yeah, I'm not too, you know, I'm not super informed on watching really young players in Europe. So I think one of the guys that Chris mentioned that I think, like, if we talk about the circumstances that you need to be a breakout star at the World Cup, I think maybe players not taking you as seriously and being in a team that isn't supremely talented but still has the ability to, like, do something at the tournament. I think of those players that Chris mentioned, Hakim Ziyech is probably the best one because people playing Morocco probably won't take the midfield too seriously and he'll have probably a lot of space to do well. So I would probably pick him out to be good. And there are so many players in that Ajax team that have been excellent this season. So I think it's probably him.
Okay, another question here on Twitter about the World Cup. Kareem Karas says, how far can Egypt go in the World Cup if Salah is on form? Who's going to be the dark horse in Russia? Okay, we'll come to that. We'll deal with the first one. How far can Egypt go in the World Cup if Salah's on form? What do you make of this, Chris? Because obviously it looks like Salah. It sort of came out yesterday that he's recovering from his shoulder injury. Egypt is saying he probably is going to be able to play in that opening game, I believe, against the Ukraine. Against Uruguay, which could be interesting. What do you make of Egypt's chances? Is it that they solely rest on Salah's shoulders, injured shoulders?
Look, he's a massive influence, obviously, he's in the attacking third, and to me, everything I've read and seen, it seems like the entire country lives by the breaths that he takes in and out. I caught a bit of them against Belgium in the night, and they weren't good. The defenders are very functional, from what I've seen, the likes of Ahmed Hegazi, who was on loan at West Brom this season, and I think he's joined them permanently now, actually. And I don't want to just reduce them to Salah because I think that's a little bit disrespectful. The other player that I quite like the look of in the attacking third is a chap by the name of Trezeguet who plays in the Turkish league. I want to say for Sivasspor. And everything I've seen of him, I think he's quite a dangerous attacker. And I wouldn't be surprised, and when we talk about breakout stars, I'm not familiar with how old he is. I don't think he's that young, personally. I'm going to just quickly check just so I don't sound like a complete nugget. 23. So, yeah, you could argue on the very fine edge of a breakout star in that sense. I think he could get a move off the back of this tournament if he performs as expected. It was actually Eric Krakauer who kind of put me onto him, a friend of mine who works now for Bein as a producer. And I think he's sort of their secret. Maybe secret weapon is too strong a word, but I think he's the one that's not getting any press that could end up being a real handy little player for him, for Egypt, excuse me.
What about dark horses? This is the other part of Karim's question here. You basically got discount Brazil, Germany, Spain, France. They're probably the four absolute favourites for the tournament. Anyone else you've got as a dark horse, Nico? Argentina maybe just about qualify. England definitely qualify.
Nah, they don't qualify. They have the greatest maybe player of all time, and they might bench Sergio Aguero.
Incredibly imbalanced squad, though. Really, are they? They're not the favorites.
Yeah, I mean, I really like them to win, and I think I'm gonna write something for someone. So keep an eye out for
but
that.
Argentina to win the World Cup. Fair play. All right.
Well, not to win the World Cup, but just being like, you know, just about their story. But I think the dark horse for me is Colombia. They have really good players all over the pitch. Davinson Sanchez, a spur for you.
I like him.
And obviously, James Rodriguez and a few other guys. So I think they are actually pretty. They have a pretty solid chance of going through and being good. The difficulty is that I don't know. I've been on this like Germany hype train for like a couple weeks now, and I don't see them. They're so good. You know, I think from a tactical perspective, Yogi Löw has everything down. He understands not to underestimate his opponents. He understands how to break down, you know, teams that are going to sit deep. They have the players to combat that. They have the players from an attacking perspective. Like, I think they have it all, and it's just impossible for me to see past Germany. So,
dark horse.
I know that wasn't the question.
Yeah, but. I mean, fair enough. Really?
You say what now?
It'll be like Spain at the last World Cup, coming to defend it.
Nah, no way. But that's why I'm saying, like, I think with Spain, painfully for me, like, Del Bosque knew that he should have. But Del Bosque said, like, I should have retired after the Euros. Like, I was not supposed to be there. They asked him to stay. Like, he knew that he should have gone. There was so much wrong. The transition from, like, one golden generation to the next was so rough. But for Germany, it's a completely different story because their coaching is more analytical. It's not so emotionally thought out. And I think the Leroy Sané exclusion, I know we haven't talked about that, but is a perfect example of like, okay, yes, you have a good player. You have a really good player. But if they're going to, in some way, shape, or form, stop you from being the best possible team and stop you from achieving your goals, then I'm sorry, it doesn't matter how good of a year you have, you just can't come. And that's not an indictment on him as a player. Yogi Löw has said he'll be involved with the team later on. I think that mindset of thinking, that mindset, we're going to be the best team, we have this approach, this, that, and the other, I think they are as well prepared as someone can be. Obviously, luck and how much, you know, chance goes into these things is a completely different thing. But I think from every perspective that you can possibly prepare for, Germany is the best possible team.
With the added context that I don't think the Germany that won in 2014 were that good either. I think that they've, in that sense, they've become a better team, definitely, in a lot of ways comparative to the 2014 team. But I look at, like, Spain, I look at Brazil, who've also become a better team and obviously didn't win in 2014, tanked massively against said Germany. And maybe even France, although I have reservations about Deschamps, I don't see Germany getting that far this time around. I think, you know, a team like that is almost guaranteed to get into the knockouts, but thereafter I don't see huge waves personally.
To finish then, a very on-brand question here from Waldo, who says, which country has the best from three, great podcast, in the World Cup this summer? That is a fantastic question, Waldo. Fair play. What do we reckon? I suppose who's going to be playing a front three for one, but maybe just the three best attackers, we'll say. Are we looking at, say, I don't know, Belgium, De Bruyne, Lukaku, Hazard? Are we looking at
France, probably?
France.
I'd probably say France.
We're talking Mbappe, yeah. Griezmann. Who else is it?
Mbappe, Griezmann, and Dembele.
Ooh, that's pretty good. Maybe Brazil, Gabriel Jesus, maybe Neymar, Coutinho, maybe. There's a couple of good attacking forces floating around. Who's got the best attack in this tournament, Nico, for you?
I think France, whether they play Dembele on the right and Mbappe on the left, or whether they play a front three at all, it's just impossible to kind of look at that attack and not imagine that it will score goals unless you have absolutely no faith in Deschamps, which some people do. I mean, that's fair. So I think it's France.
Maybe what about Argentina? Chris? Di Maria?
Dybala? Messi?
Messi? Yeah. I mean, that...
Dybala? Yeah, Dybala's in there. Dybala.
But as you said, I mean, Sergio Aguero...
celebrate Dybala.
Sergio Aguero, like you say, might start on the bench. So is it Dybala, Messi, Di Maria? That feels like an incredibly strong attack, Chris.
Icardi not even going?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, but we all know why, because Icardi's a very naughty boy. He's not the Messiah, to quote a very famous film. Yeah, Argentina are a funny one. I think, look, Sampaoli has a very clear and defined way that he likes to play. It's counter-attacking, it's aggressive. There are players within that squad that will fit, I would say, fairly well into that ethos. The problem I always have when I watch Argentina, and I did a few betting columns towards the back end of the qualifiers, Bet Responsibly Kids. And so I watched a lot of the South American game. And with Argentina, I always got the feeling that the players around Messi, they didn't necessarily elevate his talent, they just relied on it. And he would get the ball and they would just stand still, which, you know, I can understand to a certain degree. But I don't know if there's enough harmony in the team to actually thrive. I mean, the backline's a curious mix of Otamendi's and then sort of much younger players that are maybe a little bit untested at this level. Fico, who has been solid from what I've seen at Ajax since he came over. I think there's clearly talent there. There's obviously talent there, whether it's Higuain, Messi, whatever. I just don't necessarily see, or I haven't seen, I should say, a beautiful harmony in the way that they played in qualifying, which granted was a long time ago relative to when we're discussing now. But I just don't see how that will have evolved into a better situation over time.
Should we finish talking about England's attack? Been too friendly this week.
Should we finish talking about England? No, we haven't even talked about the best team. Or I just got an email today. The odds for Brazil to win the World Cup are 9-2.
Listen, we're going to be talking about Brazil a lot next week. I just want to talk about England because...
Listen, we got to talk about England because they suck. I forgot.
There's been two friendlies. Nigeria earlier in the week. Costa Rica tonight. Looks like we've got this formation with three at the back. So we can't really say front three for England because it looks like Southgate's going to be playing two up top. It was Sterling and Kane who started against Nigeria. I think it was Rashford and... was it Welbeck who started up front against Costa Rica? I mean, they're all in contention.
Inspiring confidence, Welbeck.
What do you make of that formation, Chris? And who do you think should be starting up front for England in those two places? And could they be causing trouble at the World Cup? Is it Kane alongside Sterling? Is it Kane alongside Rashford, potentially, who scored an absolute screamer tonight against Costa Rica? And who many, because they make snap decisions, feel should be starting alongside the captain in the opening group game against Tunisia?
The question was which strikers, right?
Yeah. Kane and Sterling, Rashford.
Sterling a striker now?
I mean, Teddy's a forward, but it's all inconsequential. I would say Kane and Rashford. The thing is, I mean, everyone's going to jump on Rashford after his performance against Costa Rica, which, you know, culminated in a fairly brilliant strike. I do like what Sterling offers. I think he's a slightly better dribbler. I think he makes really intelligent runs. But the trade-off is that Rashford is the better finisher, I think, of the two. Although he's not as, I would say, intelligent as Sterling with the ball, which is not to criticise Rashford. And I just think that Rashford, Kane works quite well as a pairing. The beauty is, actually, of this team in general, it's got so much pace and power across the pitch, whether it's Walker, Rose, Loftus-Cheek in midfield, Sterling and Rashford in the final third. It's no surprise to me that Southgate says that this is the formation and there's no real plan Bs or Cs, because I actually think this team's pretty adaptable as it is. Its players can play a few different positions. So if Rashford tanks, you can pull him out and put Sterling in and then see how that goes. So yeah, I think really for the first time, there's not an obvious set of starters all the time. I think it's nice. It's a bit more of an even keel.
Pace, power, adaptability, you said there, Chris. I'm reading between the lines, but you're saying we're going to win the World Cup. Is that what you're saying?
I was listening to the Lightning Seeds the other night, which a lot of our listeners will not know who they are.
Depressingly. What do you make of this, Nico? England are going to win the World Cup because Rashford's now going to start alongside Harry Kane and no one can stop them.
No. Oh, right, the key for England, and this is, I mentioned at the top of the pod that I was writing something about Pochettino's influence on England. I think the key for England is Dele Alli, because a lot of people have referenced, like, I mean, I'm basically giving away my piece here, but a lot of people have referenced, he has had a drop in form this season. He hasn't been as good. But if you look at the advanced numbers, he's been more of a creative passer, and his numbers in terms of like progressive passes and really, penetrative passes in the final third are really good. And they're very high up in the league. Like, they're up there with, like, Kevin De Bruyne is miles away in front of everyone else, but Dele Alli's closer to the top. So I think that's the biggest thing for England, is that you have an athletic specimen that's decent in the air, like Dele Alli, if you want to bypass the midfield and hit teams like very quickly and be very direct, especially with Kane as well. But you also have Dele Alli as a passer that can, you know, really put players in good positions in the final third, whether that's Sterling, Rashford, Kane, whoever. I think the guy here is Dele Alli. So I think England's hopes lie with him.
Dele Alli's going to lead England to the World Cup. You heard it here first. I'm excited, boys. I'm getting excited about seeing bloody Morocco v Iran. That's how excited I am about World Cup right now. I've got the fever. Tune in next week, guys, for the front three. You're going to be previewing every single group on Monday. On Thursday, we're going to be making our World Cup predictions. And we'll be back every day of the World Cup, fingers crossed, to give you a daily update on all the games and give our thoughts and analysis. Until then, though, thank you so much for listening. Do remember to get your reviews in on iTunes. Click the link in the description of the podcast for your chance to be the whole of the week. 5-star reviews are appreciated. Until Monday, Chris, where can the listeners find you?
On the Front 3 Twitter account, sharing everybody's work.
Lovely stuff. Nico?
They can find me at Nico_O Morales on Twitter. Where can they find you, Adam?
Find me at Adam Boltwood on Twitter. Guys, we'll see you on Monday. Enjoy the weekend.
That's a magic number. Three. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. Three. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born 3, they stubborn me, and that's a magic number.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.